So this evening, I would like to continue a little from yesterday and then also look at identity and emotions, the emotional life. So from yesterday, I like to look a little bit more about grasping and looking at sometime how we might grasp at newness. And then we kind of have to repeat the newness. I'll just give a little example. So last year in June, I was teaching in Austria, I was in Vienna, a friend took me to a restaurant, and the only thing I could eat was mushrooms. So there was a plate of mushrooms, but it was not any mushrooms. It was one of my favorite mushrooms, chanterelle. It's kind of little trumpet, kind of orange little trumpet-like mushroom. So I got the plate, arrived, and I had not eaten this mushroom in a long time. And it was fantastic. So I had a kind of, you know, I don't know, 15 mushrooms, and I ate each, the contact, the feeling tone, it was fantastic. So I would say feeling tone number 9, 9.5. Wonderful. So I appreciated each mushroom, I enjoyed them, etc. And then I finished the plate, we went out of the restaurant, and then I still had the memory of those wonderful mushrooms, and the memory was pleasant number 7. You know, and then time to time I could go to the memory and, that was nice. And I have an idea about these things, so as an experiment to confirm a little my idea, the next day I went to the same restaurant at the same time, and I had a similar plate of chanterelle. And I have my first mushroom, and it's okay. You know, it's pleasant, 5.5. So I eat my plate of more middling mushroom, but it's the same, but the experience is more middling. Then I finish it. And then I go out and I check the feeling tone of the memory. But now the feeling tone is different because now I have two memories. I have the memory of before, but now I have actually the closer memory of now. And it's really gone down to 3. And this is what I mean by what I call grasping at newness. That when we have something, that it be food or many different experiences, if we had not had them before, if we had not had them in a long time, by comparison, it's going to be amazing. But then because it's so pleasant, we want to repeat the experience. But generally, we repeat exactly the same experience, but we might not have the same feeling tone. And I think that's why we can also see that in meditation, that we start to meditate and then we might have wonderful experience. We suddenly we feel calm, or we feel clear, or we feel all loving, and in comparison to how we felt before, it's really special. It's really amazing, the difference. But if you continue to meditate, by comparison, you're going to have less difference. And so you say, oh, I've been meditating for 10 years and I don't get this amazing experience I used to get at the beginning. But I think we have to see, it doesn't mean you might not have all the special experience, but you are not going to have the same one you had at the beginning, because there you are certain condition. So I think To me, what is very interesting with these feeling thoughts is, in a way, it's nearly like a challenge. How, because it's very easy to move from this newness and to this the same, and then it goes down. And so it's nearly a challenge. How can I see everything anew? Or how can I accept everything cannot be fresh and new all the time? And I think that's something to look at in terms of the feeling toward, in terms of the grasping. Then there is another thing which I think is interesting with grasping, is grasping at something and identifying with something that is not there. I mean, that you grasp at something that's there, I say, fair enough. But often what we do is we grasp and we identify with something that is not there. And this you can, I think often, sometimes this can also happen in meditation, for example. So you're sitting in meditation, and next to you, there is this imagined meditator. And it's you, but Superman, Superwoman meditator. And then that meditator doesn't have any thought, that meditator is very calm and clear, and he generally floats a little above the cushion. And so compared to that meditator, I mean, this one is like, you know. But that one doesn't exist. It's an imagined one. The only one that exists is this one here and now. And so I think often we have this grasping at, you could say, a mythical, an imagined identity. I should be like this. I should have this. Once I had a very sad example of this. There was this person came to me and she was very troubled and she said, oh, I want so much to be rich so I can help many, many people. And I said to her, but are you rich? She said, not at all. I am extremely poor. And so she was very frustrated, because she wanted to have, in a way, that identity of being rich, and only if she was rich, then she could fulfill a hope to help many people. But I said to her, maybe you can creatively engage with your condition now. So you might not have lots of money, but maybe you have certain quality, certain capacity, and you could help people at that level. And so I think, in a way, to be careful, because sometimes it's like you have two, you have the person here, and next to it, you're comparing to this imagined person, this imagined identity. I should be a successful person, I should be the perfect mother, I should be, etc., etc. And it's interesting about that. And it's back to this expectation and aspiration. And I think often what we do is kind of we grasp at a certain expectation. I'll talk more about this tomorrow in terms of culture and society. But in terms of our identity, the expectation we might have about ourselves, in terms of our age, in terms of our society, our means, or whatever. And the difference between expecting something, which is going to kind of, in a way, blocks us and generally creates tension, and aspiration. Aspiration, which is going to give us energy to move forward, to develop, to cultivate a certain potential. And so, in a way, I think when we grasp at something which is not there, often in terms of our identity, I feel we're grasping at certain expectation. And then can we move that to more aspiring to something? I think this is also essential. Then, what is interesting in terms of identity is, in a way, wanting to be special. And this, I think sometimes there can be a lot of expectation in many different ways. I mean, we can be special in, we can want to be special in many different ways. And I remember many years ago, I was working, I was very young, and I don't know what I was saying. And then the person I was working with said, "Wow, really? I am fed up with you. You always want to be special." Like, I don't know what I was doing, but I must have said, you know, "I want to do this, I want to do that." And he said, "You know, oh, you always want to be different. You always want to be special." And it is true, I was never the relatively normal person. From a young age, I was, it's true, I was not doing things which were kind of in accordance with my age, my sex, or different things like that. But it kind of struck me that kind of like wanting to be special and how there is, in a way, within us, I feel little that I would nearly call as an identity, that heroic complex. Like when I was from a very young age, I wanted to save the world. So first I thought, you know, age 11, I want to become the president of the republic. Then I thought, maybe that's too much. So then, you know, I become like a member of parliament. And then I kind of downgraded it. Maybe I can become a journalist. And then I became a nun. I became a nun in Korea. And then that was really the top of my specialness ever. Because in Korea, I was the only French Buddhist nun there. So I was one among 60 million Korean, but I was also one among 60 million French people. So I was one among 120 million people. That's special. I think this was the epitome of my specialness. And then I stopped being a nun. I stopped being a nun. I went back to being a lay person. And at the beginning, it felt very strange. It felt funny. And then one day I thought, but what is funny? Why am I feeling funny? And I realized that actually I did not feel special because nobody looked at me as special. I was not one among 120 million anymore. I was not a special French person. I was not a special French person among Korean people. And so nobody looked at me in any way, and I was just one among other ordinary people. And to me, this was a revelation that it was wonderful to be an ordinary person and to not want to have this special identity. It was very liberating. And so from then on, I kind of, in a way, thrive on being ordinary and not having this need to be special. I think this is something to look at in terms of identity. That often we want to a special identity, either a specially good identity, or then if we can have not a specially good identity, then we'll have a specially bad identity. And that is interesting here about qualities. How we often identify with quality. Like, I am a good person. Which means, if you identify with your goodness, I am always a good person. And it's kind of nearly implying there is a little cube here, a little permanent cube of goodness within me. Always there. And if I'm a specially bad person, then again there is a little cube there, specially always bad person. If you look at it, good and bad are not intrinsic. This is what the not-self is about. Is that the potential for good and the potential for bad, yes, are there. But we are not intrinsically good or bad. And this is what the Buddha saw very clearly, that actually goodness and negativity actually arise out of conditions. And like one of, often that's what I reflect, like sometimes you hear about scandal among the great, supposedly, Zen masters, or who kind of go and do things which are really not, or doesn't seem to me very awakened and ethical. And so they can be great in one way, and in another way, they're not very great. But it's the same with Gandhi, is one of my great heroes. But if you look his life, he was really weird too. He was not a nice father, and he was kind of weird in many different ways. But we won't go into that. So in a way, you can have a very good person who does a lot of good things, but it doesn't mean that that person is always good all the time to the same degree. And so in a way, that's where the kind of the thing about the creative engagement with condition and identity, and to look, what are the conditions that seems to help me to be more wise and compassionate? What are the conditions that seems to make me more stressed, more angry? And that's why in terms of emotional life, what is interesting is that you could look in terms of identity in two different ways. There is the way of the experience. Like suddenly, either you feel very guilty, or you feel very sad, or you feel very angry, or you feel very happy, whatever. But what is interesting is that when you have a strong emotion in that way, is that it's nearly like it's all encompassing. And then it's very easy, because it's intense, to assume I am just that. And so in that moment where we have a strong emotion, we suddenly, it's kind of like we colored. It's like our identity is colored by the emotion. And we can't see anything else. Suddenly it's like we kind of this angry person, or this sad person, or this guilty person, or this happy person. And it's interesting that, and that's what I meant by the grasping, that if we grasp, then generally we amplify, but also we stuck to what we grasp at. And then that's where anatta, not self, is actually saying, yes, you have a strong emotion, but you are not just that. You are more than even the most intense emotion you can have. And so in a way it's saying, yes, am I experiencing this very strong anger, sadness, joy, guilt, but I am not just that. At this moment, in a way, anatta is about us being multi-perspectival, multifaceted, and that we cannot reduce ourselves to any one of the elements that forms us, however intense it might be. Because when there is intensity, and often with emotion, there can be a lot of intensity. When there is intensity, it's like we cannot see anything else. It's like when there is anger, it's the kind of one sees red. And in a way, it's kind of like you see everything through these colors. And your whole body-mind is taken by that. And in a way, the creative engagement is saying, yes, right now you're angry, sad, guilty, but you are not just sad, and also you are not just sad all the time. Because you can move from the experience that right now you're having this experience, And of course, you can reduce yourself to that experience, that emotional experience. But then if you have a tendency to be angry, sad, guilty, happy, then you start to assume, you start to even more identify in a general way, I am an angry person, I am a sad person, I am a guilty person, I am a happy person. I mean, once I was teaching regularly a long retreat, and so every year I would see the same person. And every year he was someone, when he did long retreat, had fantastic experiences. He was really like kind of, you know, he would have mystical experiences and meditative experiences, and he had a fantastic time. And then one year, I see him and he looks very different. And he said to me, I'm meditating, and I cannot experience like it was before. And I said, but are there any conditions in your life which would be different? And then he reflects, oh yeah, my uncle died, my niece died. And I said, you cannot have the same experience. And I think to me this is a great teaching of the Buddha in terms of identity. That actually it depends a lot on the condition. And so in a way this idea of not self is again this exploration of condition. I have a tendency to feel this. But if we look, and that's why the looking deeply into the impermanence is so essential. To me this, if somebody said to me, I am angry all the time, what does it mean? I am a sad person, I am a guilty person, I am an angry person, I am a happy person. If you say you are always like this, basically you are saying every second, every minute, every hour, every day, every week, every year, forever after. And actually it's impossible. You cannot, because of impermanence, you cannot have this kind of permanent state. So then what is interesting, of course, there can be repetition. There can be repetition. But what is, to me, what is interesting is when am I not angry or guilty or sad or happy? I mean, once I had this person who come to me and she said, I always feel guilty. And I said, I'm not sure about that. So I said, first, how does it feel when you don't feel guilty? Focus on that. Don't focus on when you feel guilty. Focus on when you actually don't have the funny feeling which you put the name guilt on. There must be some time where you don't experience it. So she tried to see, and after a while she said, it's true. At times, I don't have the feeling. Then I said, then at what time does the feeling arise? Because it seems to arise again and again. When does it arise? In what condition? And it was very interesting because she looked and looked and looked and realized actually she only felt guilty when she met one person. And so whenever she met that person, she felt guilty, but because it was an unpleasant feeling tone, then it spread. And then she would feel it for a certain amount of time. And then assume, I am a person who feels guilty, and then of course must be guilty of something. But once she realized it was actually just that one person, then she could creatively engage. Oh, how can I be with this person? And it's the same. If we have a tendency to be angry, again, generally, we're not angry all the time. And personally, I used to have a little of a easy to become angry. And what I saw with meditation is that it did not stop. Because personally, I think anger is a creative function. All emotions are creative functions. That it be guilt, that it be anger, that it be sadness, that it be joy, happiness, they're all creative function. And so the problem with all these creative emotional function is when they become habituated. That was the problem with it. And so then I started to look, when do I become angry? How does the anger start? And then you can look, there are different levels. You can be just irritable. And then I started to notice I would get irritable. And then if I was irritable, I would look for somebody to be irritated with. Because it was not my fault, it was somebody out there. Must be doing it to me. This is what is interesting. Often we kind of put the identity outside. Until I realize, wait a minute, the person has not done anything, then why am I irritable? And I realized it's when I was tired. Then I went to rest when I was tired, and then I was much less irritable. So in a way, that's what is interesting in terms of, we feel we have this emotional identity. But if we look at it, what are the building blocks? And then to see that in terms of emotion, there is generally a trigger. Generally you have certain conditions, and then you have certain contributing factors. Generally you have these three coming together. Because sometimes the trigger is there, but it doesn't matter. This was just fascinating to look at. That actually you can have a trigger, but if you're in a good mood, who cares? But if you're tired, then suddenly it's really important. So in a way, in terms of our emotional life, to see how do I restrict myself in terms of my identity by thinking I am a sad person, or I am an angry person, or I am a guilty person. And instead, noticing that actually we have quite a rich emotional life. We experience lots of different feelings. And to me, what is interesting, that's why I connect, you have the feeling tone. So you have contact. Then you have the feeling tone. Then often that can become a physical, what I would call feeling sensation, which can then become an emotion, which can then become a disturbing emotion. So actually, but often when we feel an emotion and we identify with it, it's because it's very intense. And we kind of like submerge, overwhelm. And I think what the meditation can help us to do is in a way kind of like backtrack a little. And kind of in a way look back and start to see, oh, there was a feeling tone. But also to look at the feeling sensation. Because what is interesting also is a meaning, and that's where I think the identity also comes in, is the meaning we give to the feeling sensation. And that's what we can a little observe. When we are on a retreat, you might have less emotion, it's more quiet possibly. Unless, of course, something has happened before you came. So you sit in meditation, and then notice, where generally do you feel your emotion? Sometimes it's in the belly, sometimes it's in the heart, sometimes it's in the throat. Once somebody told me he was feeling it up in his shoulder. And so generally when you feel something, it's like, ah! Somewhere around here, you feel something. So one moment you don't feel it, and it feels relatively not much, but that doesn't mean you're not feeling anything. It just means that not much is going on. So I don't think we need to feel strongly all the time, because I think it tires the system. So we were feeling not much, and then suddenly we start to feel something. And then generally, very quickly, we name it. This is that. And then this is sadness, this is anger, this is guilt, this is whatever it is. And then generally from that naming, you go into a lot of association. And I think what the meditation can help us, and then you kind of go into kind of a strong identity. I am this kind of person because in the past I have been like this, and in the future I will be like this, and I am this boring, sad, or whatever person. But if it's not too strong, we can just go inside the sensation itself, that little emotional sensation. How does it feel? Before we name it. Before we name it, it's just a different feeling. It feels a little different. It might feel pleasant. It might feel unpleasant. How is it changing? How is it moving? Is it agitated? Is it a little trembling? And to me, this, I think, is very helpful to actually help with not immediately amplifying and associating. And of course, if there is certain condition, it might become stronger. And it could become sad. Sadness, because there is something to be sad about. It doesn't mean you are always sad. Or it could become anger because you are frustrated, things are not going the way you want, you are irritable. I mean, there are many reasons one can become angry or can feel guilty. And so in a way, I think it's interesting, how does it feel? And how do I start to interpret it, to associate it? And then how does that make me kind of in a way more identified with it? And so that, to me, that's what the kind of the meditation can help us to see the process, not to judge the process. And not meaning that you can never be terribly angry or sad, but personally I feel sometime in the Buddhist tradition, you might have the impression that you must never be angry. That, I mean, anger is really a bad thing. This is really a bad thing. But personally, I think what we have to be very careful is not to use the meditation to actually stop our emotional life. Because what can happen is, somebody does something or says something, and you say, oh, it's okay, it's okay, it's impermanent, never mind. They do it again. Ah, well, you know, may be happy, may understand, or may she, and all right, it's okay, it's okay. And then they do a third time, and you shout. And they kind of say, but why did not you say something the first two times? Because you see, you might not be angry, but you might be very resentful. And, you know, kind of at some point, it will have to come out. So if you get angry, at least you know how it feels. I mean, it's relatively often, I mean, unless you, I mean, sometimes we feel justified. I am angry. I find it interesting with my mother. I take care of her, and she's losing her memory. And so I have to repeat a lot of things. And then sometimes I have this feeling, I want to be angry about this. And I know it's really not helpful. Because if I raise my voice, you can go like that, and it's really not helpful. But I can see the attraction to wanting to know, I have a good reason, and why can't I, and things like that. And I think, you know, who cares, you know, what's the point? So it just goes. But to see that in a way, that desire to be right, It's very interesting. If you are angry, how does it feel? How does it feel in the body and mind? To me, this is when I let go of it. When one, many years ago, I had a Buddhist argument with somebody. And so, you know, we had to leave it because, you know, she said, but you never do it. I said, I would do it in the future, but you know. So we kind of, you know. And then we could not finish it because I had to go and work in the kitchen. So I was working in the kitchen, I was cooking for a conference, and so I was kind of, you know, cutting carrots. And then suddenly I saw myself cutting carrots like that. And I thought, ooh, this is a little dangerous. And then I went inside the body, and the body was up. And I realized, hey, I am doing this to myself. Nobody is doing this to me. This is painful. This is unpleasant. And just by seeing that, it just went. And then I went into the mind. And in the mind, I was going, I'm right. She is wrong. I am right. She is wrong. And then I saw that she must be doing the same thing. Of course, the opposite way. And I just realized we both right and wrong. And after that, it doesn't mean I never get angry, irritable, impatient, but it's very short and very light compared to before, because in a way I have really experienced it. I really know what it is. And so I think often what we do with the emotional life is we go actually into an abstract, commenting identity. Instead of, how does it feel now to be sad, to feel guilty, to feel happy? How does it feel? It's in a way to really inhabit the experience itself, instead of, in a way, going into the commenting about it. And to me, that's when we can see that actually we can have many different emotions. But we don't have, in a way, to identify with any of them. But they're like a dance, you know. Personally, what I found very interesting is my limits. To observe my limit. I can be patient, very patient. You know, I'm a Zen person, I'm patient. Yeah, I'm patient. And then, I am patient, yeah, I'm calm, everything's fine. And then, different condition comes together, and then I am not patient anymore. And what I found interesting is that moment, where up to that 10 minutes, I was full of time, all the time in the world. But then, 10 minutes and a half, finished. And it's interesting to notice our limit, because I think this is part of our identity. What is our limit? Because they're part of what makes us. And so sometimes our limits expand, and then sometimes our limits contract. So when our limits expand, then we have this very expansive, very wide identity. Look at me, I'm this wonderful Buddhist person. And then when they contract, what do you say? This is very interesting. When you contract, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with my meditation? It's not working anymore. Well, actually, it just depends on condition. So it's kind of really interesting to notice with our identity and our emotional life. And then I wanted to just to move very briefly to one thing we can grasp at in terms of identity, which is really fascinating, and it's an idea. So you have an idea, and you have a discussion with somebody. So you have this idea, let's say they have the opposite idea. So you say something, they say the opposite. And then, you kind of, you know, that's what is interesting, when you move from a discussion to an argument or to a dialogue. When you move to an argument, basically what happens is you identify with your idea. And if the person questioned my idea, it means they question my identity, which then is very frightening. And it's very interesting when this happens, when you have a discussion with somebody, and you have your idea, and you think, my idea is the best idea, because this is a thing about idea, this is a thing about dogma. You have an idea. You think it's a good idea. You think it's the best idea. You think it's the only idea. You think everybody must think this. And this is an interesting development. And the more you go like this, the more you're going to identify. And so then, you know, you will fight for your idea. Sometimes you even kill for your idea. Instead of, what is an idea? What is an idea? Actually, an idea is just a little firing in the brain. That's all. If you look at the synaptic stuff and you see the synaptic self and things like that, you kind of see the little thing kind of coming together, and then you just need to a little bit of electricity, poof, and that's an idea. I mean, of course you can identify with a bit of electricity, but it's kind of like, you know, taking a piece of the electrical cord and saying, this is me. I am, you know, this is my electrical cord. You know, my electrical cord is better than yours. And to me this is very interesting, how we grasp and identify with something which is so intangible, but can seem so important. Instead of, you have an idea, it could be a good idea, but somebody else could have as good or better idea than you. I had a revelation many years ago. I was convinced I had the better idea about organizing bed in a room. So I bothered everybody for an hour. And then finally I could not do it, so they did it. And then I went to see, because I was so sure my idea was better than theirs. And then I went to look at the room, and their idea was so much better than mine. And then from then on I knew other people have good ideas too. But why? I mean, why do we think we have better ideas? Because we know them, and we don't know other people's idea. I mean, they're in here. And this is, in a way, I'll finish with that, why generally we think our meditation method is the best one. Because we have practiced it. And so we know this practice works for me. And then we identify, we think, oh, it works for me, then it's good, then it's a good method, it's the best method, it's the only method, it must work for everybody. But not really. I mean, it works for you, very likely it works for some people, but it doesn't mean it's going to work for everybody. And once I had this wonderful time with somebody who came here recently, Lee Brasington. And he taught a retreat here. He's a good friend of mine. And he's a very nice teacher, but we teach very differently. And he came and we stayed together 3 days. And I showed him around and we talked a lot about practice. And in the end, to me what was fascinating was that in the end, I could not say, and he could not say, that my method was as good as his. And I could not say his method was as good as mine, even though we really open. And the reason for that is because he has not experienced my method by himself, and I have not experienced his method. And so in a way, to see that at one level, we go in terms of identity and openness of identity, we're going to be restricted by the condition that forms it. And we'll talk more about this last day in terms of relationship, in terms of love, to see that we can be open, but we're little kind of not stuck, but we're little limited by the condition we know. And so, of course, we can empathize, we can open to others, but there is limit to that. Like, I really know myself. I can know you a little, but I cannot know you better than you. And this you have to be very careful. When you think that because somebody is awakened, supposedly, they know you better than you, I can tell you not. Only you know yourself better than anybody else. Then there was two small questions. I got two small notes. One was about why do we seem to focus more, some of the time, on the negative? Why, in a way, I could nearly give this theory that we need a smaller, unpleasant feeling tone to focus on it, than to, we would need the double of the pleasant feeling tone to focus on that. So we have a strong tendency toward noticing more what is painful than what is not painful. And the person was kind of curious about that. But scientifically it has been studied. It's kind of what they call the negative effect something something. That, of course, because pain is painful, we're going, I mean, it's a survival mechanism. We're going to react to it much faster, to a much lesser degree, than the pleasant feeling tone. So in a way, part of the practice is actually to balance this out. Not to negate that we have unpleasant feeling tone, yes, be with them, creatively engage, etc. But to balance it out, that negative focus, then to be as focused. That's what we're going to do tomorrow. To be as focused on what is pleasant than what is unpleasant. And then you can have a little bit kind of the balance with that. And then there was a question. In listening meditation, when hearing several sounds simultaneously, would you recommend to pay attention on feeling tone? So this is a little tricky, because when we hear sound, again, also people listen differently. I mean, if you're musical, you will hear more sound than if you're not musical. I am not very musical, so my range is a little kind of narrow. But I'm very aware that if you're musical, you can hear notes that I would not be able to hear. So when you have many different sounds, I would generally say you can either focus on kind of the general, all these different sounds and kind of more focusing, of course you could focus on the hearing faculty and the feeling tone of the hearing faculty. So again, it depends what kind of sound and how they are. Personally, I would suggest to kind of try to see, can you single out one specific sound and see how that one feels? Or if it feels like kind of like a cacophony of many different sounds, then maybe you could focus on the general feeling tone, which happens with being in this noisy environment. But again, generally I found it's generally easier to be with very lots of noise when you can focus on one. Then if you focus on the totality, sometimes it can be a little overpowering. But then it depends on your sensitivity to sound. And then when a loud sound appears, the attention goes there naturally.
Shall I stay there as long as it lasts, or pay attention to a more quiet sound? Personally, I would say, if you have generally a loud sound, I would personally, that's what I do, but I am not a kind of a subtle person in terms of listening. So generally, I would go to the one which is the biggest sound, because it's more obvious to me. And then when it goes, I go to the next, more loud one. Personally, that's what I do. But I am not very musical, and I cannot, I don't have like a very fine hearing. But if you have a very fine hearing, then of course, you can hear very quiet sound that somebody else might not hear. And then you could play around. If I hear the quiet sound, how is that? If I focus on the loud sound, how is that? So again, I would play with it and see what suits you. Anything else? Yes.
You mentioned about some negative emotions like anger, and you also talked about guilt, and I would mention shame as well. It made me think about what a certain Marshall Rosenberg said in Nonviolent Communication, which was a book that I liked very much, actually. And he didn't put all negative emotions on the same level, basically. For example, like you said, he would say that anger is very beneficial, maybe, to express something deep inside yourself, etc. And then there are some others which can be maybe more like a result of very moralistic thinking, or like when you are very judgmental or something like this. For example, like guilt. Do you agree with that, that some emotions basically come from an excess of judgmental thinking, or do you think that basically all emotions are just very good to have in a way? Do they give a deeper message that, okay, maybe there's a way of thinking that I could improve or reflect upon?
I think they all have a creative function. But then if they become habituated, often they can have a negative effect. So basically, if you look at something like guilt, it can be, you know, it's good to be aware that you made a mistake and you don't want to do it again. So you see, it's there is kind of noticing, oh, I made a mistake. Mm. In Buddhism, they have this interesting concept of iri and otapa, and it's kind of two type of, you could say, guilt. But it's kind of, you could say, healthy guilt, kind of to make you understand, oh, I made a mistake, I hurt myself, or I hurt somebody, and it could be a good idea not to do it again. And so I think, you know, different emotions have different things like that. But when you look at judging is the same. Judging is actually a creative function. You see, I think I talk of emotion, but I would say physical sensation, emotion, and mental activity all go together. And so sometimes you might have more the emotion come first, sometimes more the thought come first, sometimes the physical sensation come first, like with anxiety. But generally at some point, they all come together and kind of influence each other. And so, for the sake of discourse, we say, oh, emotion, thought, physical sensation, but I think we can assume that they all kind of, you know, combine in some ways. But if you take judging, I mean, it's a very important creative function. It's with the judging that you're going to get to wisdom. You know, I need to know, these are flower and this is a candle. I mean, I can try to lead the tulip, but I don't know, unless something changes in the universe, not much is going to happen. So it's just this kind of basic discrimination function to know, to judge. But then if it becomes habituated, then it can be something very controlling or something kind of very heavy. And then the problem you have sometimes with meditation is you have the judging of the judging of the judging. And so with judging, I think with different things, what I would say is with different emotion or different mental habits, we have to deal with them in different ways. We cannot apply the same way. With anger or with sadness, we have to apply things very differently. With anxiety or guilt, we have to apply things differently. And with judging, I would say it's very different than dealing with daydreaming. With judging, it's like you have this difficult friend. So you still like the friend, but it is or she difficult. So you're going to approach that friend differently than an easy friend, where you feel very friendly and it's easy, and you're going to, oh yeah, never mind. If you have a difficult friend, you're going to be a little careful. So I'm going to see them, I'll be careful with what I say, and da 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 da. I have a brother-in-law like this. We have to be careful around him and not do certain things. And I think it's the same with judging. Judging, you have to be very careful with judging. Very gentle, very little space, because so quickly you can have the judging of the judging of the judging. And that, I think, is kind of something, in a way, to be creative in meditation with that, I think, which is different than if you do planning or if you do rumination. It's a different thing happening. So personally, I would look more at it in those terms. And we have to stop here.